The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Okay, we're going to be eventually focusing on the appearances of Jesus in chapter 20, and particularly his appearance to the disciples in the upper room. But as before, we need to spend a little bit of time getting a sense for the context, and I think it is especially important that we try to appreciate just how significant, I mean, in a sense it seems obvious, the passion narrative, you know, of course that's significant, but to appreciate its significance specifically in the within the framework of the Gospel of John, trying to get a sense of how the passion narrative in John is a little different from what we have in the Synoptics. What does that tell us about John's Gospel itself? So that's the first thing we're going to do, look at the Passion Narrative, chapters 18 and 19, but primarily 19. And to begin with, let me give you a little quotation from our friend Brody, who says, John does indeed tell fully of Jesus' death and resurrection, yet rather than speaking of two distinct processes, namely dying and rising, he tends to a significant extent to portray a single unified process, that of Jesus' glorification. So as you read chapters 19 and 20, try to appreciate that John is presenting those two events not as two distinct processes, but really a unified whole. And as we have been hinting, you know, throughout the semester, and we're going to look at it a little bit more carefully, that whole combined set of events, the arrest, the trial, crucifixion, burial, resurrection, all of that needs to be viewed as a Jesus' glorification. Now, with regard to the basic structure of the Passion Narrative in the Gospel of John, Raymond Brown gives a fairly persuasive, and at the very least, I think it's an instructive way of looking at how the material gets divided up. Chapters 18 and 19, he sees as being formed by three basic sections. The first one, dealing with the arrest itself and the interrogation, would be chapter 18, verses 1 to 27. And when you look at these 27 verses, you see that in effect it is made up of these two basic events, the arrest itself and then the trial when he's interrogated. And in between you have a couple of verses that simply said the change of scenes. The second major section goes from 18:28 to 19:16a. And there you have the trial before Pilate, as distinct from the interrogation before the high priest. And Brown goes on to list the various units here, first the request of the Jews to Pilate, the initial questioning, Pilate seeking the release of Jesus, the scourging, and so on. And then finally, the third major section here would be from 19:16b. to verse 42, where we have the description of the execution and the burial. It's fairly simple, and we're going to see that the basic simplicity of the way this narrative is structured continues into chapter 20. Now, again, trying to figure out what is distinctive about the way in which John describes the Passion, one of the things to look at is to identify details which are omitted by John. You find them in the other Gospels, but John does not care to tell us about them. And the list is fairly long and, I think, rather significant. And I think it's worth reflecting on this because it surely tells us a good deal about John's motivation in writing the Gospel. And I think it also tells us something of what I have mentioned before, that John really does assume that the people to whom he's writing already know the basic gospel story as you have it in the synoptic tradition. And so he's trying to do something else, and he doesn't feel a particular need to repeat many of the details found in the synoptics. So first of all, what about things that are found in all three synoptics, but which John omits? Well, there's the reference to Simon Cyrene. That's in all three synoptics, but John says nothing about him. The temporal reference about the time from noon until, from the sixth to the ninth hour, from noon to 3 o'clock. All the synoptics, for some reason, make a point of giving us that information. John says nothing about it. The reference to darkness, to the darkness that fell upon the land at the time of the crucifixion, nothing about that in the Gospel of John. The fact that Jesus utters a loud cry, it's not there in John. The rending of the veil, not mentioned by John. The reaction of the centurion to the events. And beyond that, details like the wrapping of the body after he dies, and the comments about Jesus, about the women visiting the tomb. Now that's quite a list. And John tells us nothing about that. But as if that were not enough, now you start looking at some of the other details that are found in at least one or two of the other synoptics, not all three, but at least one or two of them. And you have details like the wailing of the women. Wailing, yeah. Or the reference to the drugged potion. The prayer for forgiveness. Forgive them for they don't know not what they do. The repentance of the thief. The specific cry, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. Father, in your hands I commit my spirit, and so on. The reference to the earthquake and the open tombs in Matthew. The repentance of the multitudes, and the fact that Pilate officially confirms the death of Jesus. Oh, and also the purchasing of the spices by the women. Now, if you think about that, you see, part of the problem we have is that we're so familiar with the details of the crucifixion, we hear about them all the time, and we've read and so on. And when we read the Gospel of John, even though John doesn't mention them, we're probably imagining these, we're seeing them, you see. and we fail to notice what a distinct impression is given as a result of the different way of describing the events. But the resulting impression, and here I'm quoting from Barnabas Linders in his commentary, where he summarizes by saying, there are no taunts by the bystanders, there's no mention of the darkness at noon, there's no cry of dereliction, there is a pervading calm. He goes on to say, like an Italian primitive painting, if that helps you. But the pervading calm that contrasts with the sense of disaster, fear, that you're more likely to sense when you read the synoptics. And that probably is not accidental. I think it is no doubt part of the whole motivation behind the writing of the gospel, to present the crucifixion of Jesus in a different way, let's say in a more positive light, but that obviously has to be qualified. So, lots of things omitted, but on the other hand, it's just as important to note a number of details that John includes and that are distinctive to John's narrative. Now, Dodd, in his book, has a whole bunch of them, but some that I think are particularly important to note are the reference to Jesus' voluntary suffering. Jesus goes to death voluntarily. This is not something pressed upon him. He lays down his own life. That's an important theme that is not present in the Synoptics, but is highlighted in the Gospel of John. For some reason, John stresses the political side of the charge against Jesus. There's a sharper focus on that aspect of the trial, that there's a political accusation. The reference to the kind of death that Jesus was dying. We'll come back to that in just a couple minutes. Moreover, when you look at the Old Testament quotations and the prophecies that John tells us were fulfilled, it's a different set of quotations from the ones you find in the Synoptics. And again, we may have time to look at a couple of those. Only the Gospel of John has a reference to Jesus addressing the mother and the beloved disciple, here's your son, here's your mother. Only John has reference to tetelestai, it is finished, or they are finished, because we'll see that again, but the subject seems to be panta, all things are finished. And only John has reference to the throwing of the spear, and then the blood and water flowing from the side. And again, we'll talk about that. But let me say that Dodd, as he goes through this list, and he has a bunch of other items, what is distinctive in terms of what John actually includes, he summarizes that by saying, it appears then that the Passion narrative is given in the main as a straightforward story with only a minimum of intruded interpretative elements. At most, they are small and unobtrusive hints at the inner meaning. Now, I might want to phrase that a little bit differently. I think some of these interpretive elements are perhaps stronger than this particular statement might seem to imply. But Dodd's point is that when you read the narrative in comparison with the synoptics, you do not get the impression that that John is just rewriting the whole thing to give a lot of theological or symbolic interpretation. It's a fairly straightforward accounting of what happened. And his point is that the evangelist has already, prior to the actual passion narrative, has already given plenty of interpretation, you see. And now, when he gets to the actual passion narrative, he shows that the facts bear out the interpretation to which he has been building all along. And Dodd goes on to say this on page 432. Dodd 432. We are, of course, intended to understand the passion narrative in the light of all that has been said in earlier parts of the gospel, directly and indirectly, about the meaning of Christ's death and resurrection. John expects us to read this narrative, which is fairly straightforward, to read it in the light of all that he has been saying earlier about the meaning of Christ's death and the resurrection. Now, he gives us some explicit hints about the fact that you're supposed to do that. For instance, in chapter 18, verses 8 and following, well, in verse 7, the people who have come to arrest him say that they're looking for Jesus of Nazareth. Verse 8, Jesus answered, I have told you that I am the one, or egoimi. If you're not seeking me, let these go. Verse 9, he na plerothei halagos, so that the word might be fulfilled, which he spoke, that you gave, those whom you gave, I have not lost even one of them. Now, this is, I think, a very, very important little detail. Important, first of all, because of what I have just mentioned, that John, as you're beginning here, the this is fairly early in the Passion narrative, he is directing the reader to think about what has happened before. This is being fulfilled, what Jesus had said. That alone, I think, is important. But also very important is the fact that, obviously, you see, when Jesus said, "Those, you know, not one of those whom you have given me will be lost," he must have had something else in mind than just these people not being arrested. Now, you can look at that in a couple of ways. One way is to say, well, some banal redactor didn't really understand the profundity of the gospel, and he says, look, they didn't get arrested, so maybe that's what Jesus was talking about. Or you can realize that it is one more out of a whole series of these clues and hints that John gives you, where you see the outward or the physical, and you're supposed to be able to see beyond that. Supposed to be able to see beyond that. Of course, that the action that was spoken about, that is being referred to here in fulfillment of Jesus' word, by the way, the reference is back to chapter 17, verse 12, in the high priestly prayer. The action in that's taking place here in the arrest is a sign of a broader truth. And that truth had also been expressed back in chapter 6, verses 37 to 40. Chapter 6, verses 37 to 40. So by looking at this, relatively speaking, a trivial element, let these go, John is expecting you to remember this broader truth that those whom the Father has given to Jesus will not perish. Another example of this is in the same chapter, chapter 18, verse 32. In verse 31, Pilate Pilate had said to the Jews, you take him and judge him according to the law. But the Jews said to him, it is not permitted for us to kill anyone. Verse 32, he na halagas to Jesu pleirothe, so that the word of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he said when he was indicating the kind of death that he was going to die. I referred to that earlier. Now, again, you see, this is a pulling of details together that are very, very crucial. The Jews execute now by stoning. But Jesus had indicated that he was going to be lifted up. The kind of death theme that we have seen before, where it finally was brought out more directly in chapter 12. So, Pilate wanted to get rid of him. You take care of this man. The Jews say, we cannot do it. It is not permitted to us. And, you know, there's some discussion about the historical details of this, and I don't think we need to worry about that right now. But as the Jews, who in other situations might not have been that worried about not pursuing their own legal means, but this time they decide not to press that and just to let the Romans take care of it. And so Jesus will die by crucifixion. So, you know, in a sovereign way, God is in fact bringing to pass what Jesus himself had said about the manner of death in which he was going to die. And that brings us back to chapter 12, verse 32, and even back to Jesus' statements to Nicodemus with regard to just as the serpent was raised, so the Son of Man will be raised, etc. Now let me read to you a portion here again from Dodd. This comes from pages 434 to 435. Thus, the process of man's salvation is a process of katabasis, descent, and anabasis, going up. This process is carried through by the Son of Man on behalf of all. Remember in chapter 12, verse 2, el cuso pantas el cuso, I will draw all to me. So he comes down, goes up, in the process of drawing all to him. Then Dodd goes on to say, in connection with this narrative of the arrest and trial and so on, we have just read how he was betrayed by a false follower, put in chains, and insulted with blows. Now the final indignity awaits him, crucifixion. It is the lowest step in the katabasis of the Son of Man. But for this final step, the evangelist word is hupsothena, to be exalted. And there lies the paradox. The bottom of the descent is exaltation. Now you see what I meant earlier when I was talking about John in his description of the Passion. He gives it a more, quote-unquote, positive spin. And what I mean by that is that even though it may not be explicit as you read the passage, we have plenty of evidence that one of the most frequently held charges by the unbelieving Jews against the church was this ridiculous idea that Jesus could be the Messiah. How could you possibly think that someone who's been crucified, who has come under the divine curse, because you have those passages in Deuteronomy and so on about cursed is anyone who hangs on a tree and so on. It makes absolutely no sense for a crucified person to be thought of as the Messiah. And that way of thinking, I believe, is reflected in the way in which Paul, for example, talks about, when he quotes Deuteronomy and so on in Galatians 3, etc. And that undoubtedly you have plenty of Jews in the first century who reject the gospel on the grounds of this disgusting scene of a crucified man being presented as the one who's going to solve problems for you. So the bottom line becomes, you see, that I think John is saying to these unbelieving Jews who are causing problems for Christians at the end of the first century, the very thing that you find disgusting is your salvation. And you need to understand the crucifixion in its positive sense, because you cannot separate crucifixion from resurrection. And therefore, what appears at first blush to be the utmost indignity, and it is in one sense, yet at the very same time, it is the exaltation. It is the raising of Jesus. It is here that that the goal is being achieved. Now, say, well, that's reading quite a bit there on 18:32. So the word might be fulfilled when he spoke about the kind of death that he was going to die. But there are a couple of other details in chapter 19 that I think are really do confirm and maybe even make clear. At least if you look at these details, not in isolation from anything else, but in terms of the framework of the kinds of things we've been talking about. One of them is in chapter 19, verse 30. Well, beginning with verse 28, after these things, Jesus, knowing that already panta tetelestai, here's where you have the that subject, panta, all things were finished or completed, in order that the scripture might be fulfilled, he says, I thirst. So they give him, the sponge and so on. Then verse 30, after he received it, Jesus said, tetelestai. And again, probably it isn't simply a matter of it is finished, but all things are completed now. Kai klinas ten kephalein paredo ken topneuma. Bowing his head, he paredo ken topneuma? Paredo ken? Now, if you go to, I think Matthew has the verb afiemi, which would be perhaps the more expected, more likely to be a seen verb in this kind of context. To use the verb paradidome in connection with dying, of, committing the spirit to God or whatever, is highly unusual. In fact, I am not aware that there's any parallel to this. And I find it very, very difficult to not see some significance in this. He delivered the Spirit. Now again, all by itself in isolation, you may not want to put too much weight on that, but in the context of everything else we've been reading in the Gospel, it seems to me almost inevitable that we ought to read this as some kind of allusion to this increasingly important theme in the Gospel, that Jesus is the one who gives the Spirit to his people. Now, don't misunderstand me here. I am not saying that at the point where Jesus dies, that is the point where the Spirit is given. I do think this is a reference to he died. What I'm saying is, in a way, what I have been saying many times, that John uses the kind of language that is supposed to help the reader appreciate the significance of what is going on. And when he says paredo kentop pneuma, again, I'm not saying that he objectively at that point gave the Spirit to his people. But John is saying, okay, now it's all ready. Now you have to remember what this is all about. It is a matter of the Son of Man giving the Spirit to his people. And then, of course, the other detail that I think supports this in a striking way is the paragraph that follows. The Jews didn't want the body to remain in the cross. And eventually we have this soldier throwing the spear. And verses 34 and 35, particularly the end of 34, kai exalten euthus haima kai hudor. And blood and water immediately came out. As you probably know, there has been a lot of discussion about this particular detail in the history of the church, particularly the past couple of hundred years. And I suppose 95% of the discussion is a discussion of anatomy. You know, why? What is this water that comes out with the blood? And you have medical doctors writing articles, you know, about this. And you probably heard of some of the theories. Well, this is evident proof that he really did die, you see. And that's why John is saying, because if something happens to the heart, there's this fluid that comes out, and I don't know. Well, there are a couple of things to keep in mind here. First of all, John is the only evangelist who mentions this detail. The only one of the four Gospels that says anything about it. Moreover, that statement is followed immediately by an affirmation of the truth of what this eyewitness saw. Kai ho heorakos me marturiken, he who saw it has witnessed. Kai alethineo tu estin he marturia. Kai kenos oidin hoti alethele, he knows that all things are true. It's a really very vigorous affirmation of the truth. Now, why do we have this affirmation here? Now, some people have suggested that if indeed the reference to the water and the blood is supposed to prove in some sense that really Jesus had died. And I mean, frankly, I think that anatomy was the last thing in John's mind right when as he was writing this. And I guess I doubt seriously that very many readers would have made that kind of connection. But even if you argue, well, you remember the Gospel of John written in the context of Gnostics and they were denying the reality of Jesus and that's why this is so important to him, he's really human and so on and so forth. Even if you make allowance for that, this seems almost out of place here. I think it is one more way in which John is saying to us as readers, you better understand the great significance of what I'm telling you right now. And how could you possibly, after you have been reading about water from chapter 1 and chapter 2 and chapter 3 and chapter 4, then again, especially in chapter 7, how could you possibly read this, immediately blood and water came out of his side, and not make the connection? Now you remember when we were talking about John chapter 6, and I pointed out a certain parallel in the structure between Exodus And John, and we have 15, chapters 15, 16, and 17, where there's a miracle about God providing water in the desert in Exodus 15, and then the water in the case of the Samaritan woman. The manna is related in chapter 16 of Exodus, and we have Jesus as the bread of heaven. And then in chapter 17, water from the rock, and perhaps the parallel with Jesus' renewed promise there, the Feast of Tabernacles, he who drinks of this water, he who believes in me, rivers of water will flow out from him. And he was saying this concerning the Spirit, that he was going to give to those who believed in him. But the Spirit was not yet, because he was not yet glorified. But now he is glorified, isn't he? Because you have been reminded that this was done to fulfill his word about the way in which he was going to die, hupso thanai. Now this has happened. And, you know, a number of people in the past have made a real point about the apparent allusion to chapter 17 of Exodus when you're reading chapter 19 of John. In chapter 17 of Exodus, you remember the context there where the people are very angry at Moses because there's no water. And you have the reeve motif in that chapter, and it's very plain that this is not just some minor disagreement. They're ready to court-martial Moses right there and then. And they're trying God, they're tempting and testing God, and you cannot do that because in the previous chapters, God has been testing the people. Now, the people are turning the tables and testing God. You cannot do that. And God, if you will, takes it personally. You know, Moses, don't worry. They're doing this against me. So what are you going to do? Well, obviously, you're going to destroy them. Can't do that. So you go to the rock, and I will be on the rock. And, of course, the word, the name rock, it becomes the great epithet for God in the wilderness. And this is repeated so many times in the Psalms. And God stands on the rock, and God says to Moses, strike the rock. And when he strikes the rock, it is God being struck. And this means water and life for the people. And again, not everybody agrees with this, but it is, for me, difficult not to see some allusion to that even here at the crucifixion. You know, when you think, actually, I guess the first time I heard this was from Edmund Clowney, but even he had been anticipated. Because you remember the hymn, Rock of Ages, cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. Let the water and the blood from thy riven side which flowed be of sin the double cure. And this linking of the rock metaphor with the statement in the Gospel of John that water and blood came out of Jesus' side and therefore was the means for making provision for life for God's people. Well, even if you think that's a little bit too much, I think it'd be a great mistake to miss in John's description of the crucifixion the way in which he is tying together these very, very fundamental themes that have been brought about and developed in the course of the gospel. I did want to read another section from Dodd that I think ought to be of some help here. Reading here, beginning with page 438. I'll take the time to do this. In chapter 19, 34 and 35, the evangelist draws special attention to the fact that after the death of Christ on the cross, water and blood issued from his side. The reference to chapter 655 and to chapter 738 is inevitable. In chapter 6, it was left undefined how Christ would give men his flesh and blood, though the attentive reader might divine it, especially from chapter 6, verse 51. Then in chapter 7, 38 and 39, the water which issues from his body is equated with the Spirit, which cannot be given until Christ is glorified. But again, we're left in doubt what is meant by doxasthenai, to be glorified. Now, however, we know what it means. And it becomes finally clear that the sustenance of the eternal life in man depends on Christ's death as self-oblation in fulfillment of the will of God. Guided, then, by the pointers which the evangelist has provided, and now he's talking not just about this last item, but about some of the others that he has been discussing, we find in the story of the arrest, trial, and crucifixion of Jesus Christ a semeion sign on the grand scale, to whose significance each detail contributes. Christ's self-surrender in the garden, the transference of his case to the Roman court, his defense upon the charge of claiming kingship, the way he died, the efflux of blood and water from his body after death, each of these details calls up by association a chain of ideas already expounded in the course of the earlier parts of the gospel and concentrates them upon this crucial event. Our attention thus directed, we can hardly fail to see that the motives of a whole series of semeia are gathered up in this supreme semeion, the sign of the wine of Cana, which we now perceive to be the blood of the true vine, the sign of the temple destroyed to be raised again, the signs of the life-giving word, the sign of the bread of Siloam, which is the light of truth, saving and judging, the sign of Lazarus, life victorious over death, and so on. Along with these, there are other symbols which, although they have not been embodied in dramatic incidents, have been woven into the discourses. And they have their significance clarified and enhanced in this supreme sign. Moses' serpent, the living water, the good shepherd, the grain of wheat, the woman in travail. As everywhere, so most emphatically in the story of Christ's arrest, trial, and crucifixion, what happens and is observed in the temporal and sensible sphere signifies something else, the eternal reality. And by the way, probably Dodd is operating with some kind of Platonic dualism, but I think you can find instruction here and put in a somewhat different framework, and it definitely works. This is the life eternal given to man through the eternal word. In this sense, the passion of the Lord is the final and all-inclusive semeion. Yet, it differs from all other signs. The difference might be expressed in this way. The healing of the blind, the feeding of the multitude, the raising of Lazarus, doubtless happened, but the happening had no lasting objective effect in history. The multitude might eat the loaves and be filled, but there the matter ended, unless they saw signs. They were soon hungry again. Not the event, but the eternal reality it signifies brings real satisfaction of man's hunger for life. Lazarus is raised to life, but in the course of nature his body will die again. The only lasting effect is that which his bodily resurrection means. He who lives and believes in me will never die. But with the event of the cross, it is not so. Here is something that happened in time, but with eternal consequence. Though individual men may miss its significance, nevertheless the thing has happened and history is different. The whole setting of human life in this world is different. It is an epoch-making event. In history, things can never be the same again. But more, in it, the two orders of reality, the temporal and the eternal, are united. The Word is made flesh. It is an event in both worlds. Thus, the cross is a sign, but a sign which is also the thing signified. The preliminary signs set forth so amply in the Gospel are not only temporal signs of an eternal reality, they are also signs of this event in its twofold character as Word and as flesh. They are true, spiritually, eternally true, only upon the condition that this event is true both temporally or historically and spiritually or eternally. And again, even though it is true, Dodd is operating here with a particular philosophical perspective that we might want to adjust a little bit. I think the point he's making rings true in terms of the character of the gospel and the way in which the text builds up. This is that great sign, which is more than just a sign. It is the reality itself upon which to which these other signs were looking. And it is both a historical reality and itself the eternal reality that everything else has been leading up to. So you really need to appreciate that in chapter 19, there is a certain climactic element that has to be taken seriously. Now, as we'll see in just a few minutes, chapter 20, there are still some other threads that need to be pulled together. But in terms of dramatic climax, it is probably here rather than more explicitly and objectively the resurrection that you find that climax in terms of the drama of the narrative. And that alone, again, ought to tell you something about the way in which John is perceiving the whole story. The crucifixion is indeed the glorification. Not by itself. I mean, you do need the resurrection. Otherwise it doesn't work. But here is where things finally, come home, if you will. Well, any questions about chapter 19 before the break? The one point where I think most commentators are agreed upon is that this paragraph has a function within the larger context of the claim that the beloved disciple has to give witness to these truths. And very likely in the context of some sort of polemic. But how the paragraph functions in its own unit, that it's a little harder to answer. And I'm not sure that I don't want to put myself in the position of cornering myself, if you will, and having to say, not being willing to admit that John may give certain details about things that actually happened. And this happened here, and it's important for people to know that this happened, even though you cannot see exactly how it advances the narrative itself at this point. And I don't recall that Dodd has much to say about that either. Let me see. He does talk about it, but not... this is really helpful. The episode of the mother and the beloved disciple is peculiar to the fourth gospel. Whatever its motive, it does not seem to be dictated by the Johannine theology. It may belong to a special form of the tradition. Period. So if Doc can get away with that, I don't feel too bad about not being able to answer your question.